So I will begin for the tape purposes. This is John Marty. I'm state senator from Minnesota, so I deal with state, not national issues. Today's topic is public policy that looks beyond the next election and had a subtitle, How Tackling Problems Such as Illiteracy and Poverty is Cheaper Than Ignoring Such Crises. And I would make an argument that I don't think I'll get a lot of disagreement with, that government seldom takes a long-term approach. And that goes true, that holds true not just for the federal government or for Minnesota state government, but for every state government and frankly most local governments as well. Usually government tends to work more on a crisis-to-crisis management basis rather than a long-term look at things. It tends to ignore things that one could do to prevent problems. Government tends to ignore things that are cost-saving in the long run, preferring short-term savings to long-term savings, even though the short-term savings often are false savings because they're more expensive in the long run. Why do these things occur? I'll suggest three reasons and see if others may have other ideas on this. The first of which is human nature. Perhaps the expression, never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, is truly part of most of us, perhaps. The ability to set aside something that you don't have to deal with, we tend to do, and whether that's laziness or procrastination, somehow I think it's a big part of human nature, and one of the reasons government does not tackle things it does not need to or is not forced into tackling right away. The second reason, I'd argue, is that there are more pressing problems, crises that we have to face now, perhaps because we didn't prevent the problems that caused them 10 years ago or 15 years ago, but now they become crises and we have to deal with them. And they demand a lot of attention, which means time, and certainly a lot of resources. And get to the crime example. Sure, there are lots of things we could do to prevent crime, either by preventing people from developing into criminals, which I think there are some things we know we can do about that, or neighborhood watch type of programs, local crime prevention programs that we can do. Those things don't require that many resources to do, but they do require resources, and boy, we got to build the prisons to handle these dangerous people who have done terrible things. And that's very, very expensive, so that's a case of meeting the immediate needs, the short-term crises prevents us perhaps from looking longer term, even though it's smarter in the long run to do that. And the third reason I'll suggest is re-election cycles. Almost every political office in the United States is 2, 4, or 6 years long, and most of them being 2 or 4 years long. And if I want to look good for my next re-election, I can put in place some program that has a payback in 10 years and is going to look really great 10 years from now, but what good is that going to help me in the short term? Matter of fact, it may cost more money now and save more money later, but that's not going to look too good in the next re-election. So consciously or subconsciously, politicians have this real strong incentive to look at the short term, and I'd argue 2 years is very short term. The fourth and final reason I'll throw out and see if others have other ideas is a lack of vision, a lack of a far-sighted vision, lack of ability to look ahead. We just don't take the time to think, what's going to be happening? What are we going to do? We've been talking a lot this week about garbage. We, as a society, build things, buy things, do things without thinking about what's going to happen after the initial purpose of that item or product or service is done with. We don't think about what happens later, and is that going to cause problems long term? We lack that vision in many cases. I guess I'd like to open up, see if others have other kinds of ideas why you think, assuming people here tend to agree that government does not take a long term approach. I think those tend to summarize most of them, but
things change a lot, you think, over the last, say, 50 years or so. The reason I ask that is that I'm from California. And I know during the 40s, we had a lot of tax income because of the war, something like that. They postponed a lot of things, but they planned ahead for all the freeways, right or wrong. They just planned it anyway. And they also planned for water. And they haven't done much since that, since the 40s and 50s. It's sort of been a crisis from then on. And it's even worse today than it ever has been. So things change,
I'm not sure. I think you're right. There were some great examples in the past. I'd argue in Minnesota, there were a couple of far-sighted in Minneapolis park commissioners who purchased land around some of the beautiful lakes in Minneapolis. And boy, we all benefit from them. And do we do the same for posterity? I'm not sure we do. I mean, I think on a state level, we're doing some of that. And they undoubtedly could have done more back then, too. Freeway planning. I think you're right that some of that's happened throughout in the past. I think some of that is happening now as well. Whether it's more or less, whether the problem's getting worse or better, I'm not sure. But clearly in most areas, government is not now looking ahead. Whether government 40 years ago was looking ahead, I don't know. And one of the problems in trying to look ahead is you don't know what the changes are going to be. Sometime 20 years ago, there's a Club of Rome, which was a group of scholars put together and came up with what crises the world was going to face down the road. Shortage of food, shortage of energy, natural resources. It was kind of a very depressing thing to read because you look at all the statistics and we're running out of all these resources. Well, critics of that sort of thing pointed out rightly that if you were in New York City in the 1850s and you projected what was going to happen to the population, New York City by now would be 40 feet deep in horse manure from horse traffic. And of course that didn't come about being because of new technology and new changes. So even if we do look ahead, it's hard to predict what happens. So I don't know, in direct answer to the question, I'm not sure if things are getting, if there's less planning now than there was then. There certainly is some planning going on now. In, I think, every state and government, there's some looking ahead. It's often too little, too late, but some of that kind of thing is happening.
Question. Is the governor in a better position to do, because of the position and the fact that it doesn't have to reach quite as many consensus, is he in a better position to develop long-range plans and visions?
Than legislators or than president or?
Rather than congressman.
I would suggest an executive is in the best, chief executive of a state or the federal government. They're the ones who can best present a vision for something. They're the ones who can best look ahead and adopt that vision. I mean, I may have some ideas on what I think we should be doing for the long term. I don't have the soapbox or the clout a governor has or executive at any level has to promote that plan. So they're certainly in the best place to do it. And I'd also argue a governor probably is in better shape than a president is to do it. Just because change can happen much more quickly at the state level, and even more so at the local level. Somebody comes up with if I have what I think is a creative idea for a piece of legislation that may be somewhat controversial, I can come up with an idea in February and it can be in state law by June. If you're trying the same thing at the federal level, you come up with a creative idea 5 years later, if you're lucky, it might. Granted, it might not pass at the state level, but even if it's going to pass at both levels, it may take five times as long at the federal level. So I suggest executives have more ability to control this kind of thing than legislative branches do. And states, local governments more than states, and states more than federal government, just because of the sheer size of it. Anyway, what I'd like to spend much of the time doing is to be going over some of the types of where I think long-term planning is needed that is not happening, and perhaps why it is. I'd like to throw out some and then find out other, discuss each one as we go and find out what other ones people have. One of the first ones I'd like to talk about is energy conservation. the United States certainly produces a lot of its own energy resources, whether coal or natural gas, oil we have some of. We also import a lot. Some of our states, I mean, speaking strictly parochially in Minnesota, we import almost all of our stuff. We have a little wood stuff, a little bit of wind power, a little hydropower, a little bit of that, but all of our coal comes from elsewhere, all of our natural gas is from elsewhere, all of our oil is from elsewhere. And in Minnesota, we had a proposal this year, one of my colleagues threw out, spend $6 million, which is not that big of an amount of money in our state budget, to weatherize, to improve energy usage in state facilities, state buildings. And when you count higher education facilities in the state and state institutions, prisons, hospitals, things like that, state offices, there are a whole lot of things you can spend money to save money on. And the projections from the department who was working on this proposal were that it would have a great payback in 7 or 8 years, would have totally paid for itself, maybe some of it in, much of it in 5 years. But after that, it's all free. And instead of using that money on importing resources from somewhere else, you're spending it on Minnesota jobs, Minnesota businesses, and so on. So not just from a parochial interest is it good, but also it saves, once you've spent made the expenditure, it's pretty much a permanent savings. And so once you reach the payback period, it's all gravy from then on. Why didn't we do it this year? Well, it was a great idea, but we didn't have the money. I suggest that energy conservation is one area where we can certainly save money in the long term in doing it. And for environmental reasons, I say a lot of these things, the long-term approach may often, not always, but may often save money, which is, in my mind, a worthwhile reason in itself for doing it. But there's another reason, and that is in the energy reasons, certainly environmental protection. We look at the problems. Glenn Mogelson had a talk the other day on risks of every kind of power. I might not agree exactly what the comparative risks of those are, but certainly most kinds of power generation are not only costly, but many of them have environmental consequences we have to deal with. Energy conservation has very few environmental consequences. If we, I would suggest how Holden Village could save a ton of electricity, but it's not a high priority here because they have, this is one of the few places in the country where there's a surplus of electric power, at least in the summer. I mean, there's more, they could spend a little bit more to get more efficient lighting fixtures, and more efficient light bulbs, and save money if they were paying commercially for electric power. And environmentally, it would be a better deal, but in this one particular community, that may not make a lot of sense to do. For most of us in our own houses, compact fluorescent bulbs at 18 watts that replace bulbs that are 60 to 75 watts, and last longer, so pay for themselves several times over. That makes good sense for us to do, and government could certainly be leading the way in that. Another area I would suggest we have some pretty good proof of the effectiveness of it, as well as some common sense logic about it, is the area of child nutrition. The WIC program, the Women, Infant, Children Nutrition Program, which is a federal program that a few states give additional subsidies to, takes high-risk children, usually low-income children, and provides a subsidy for certain types of nutritional products, generally milk, cases infant formula, cheeses, dairy products, things like that. Certain WIC-approved foods are available to these families so that mothers or parents are not skimping on making sure their children have an adequate diet. There's some long-term studies on the impact of WIC that suggest in healthcare costs alone, they save $3 for every dollar invested in the program. Who can argue with the economics of that? And those are often short-term costs. I mean, I think you can make an argument that we'd probably save that within 3-4 years. I don't remember the exact timeline on it, but just in the healthcare cost, there is that. Plus, there is actually a measurable impact on special education costs, because children who are malnourished early in life do worse in school, and one child in special education costs many times what a typical educational cost is per pupil. Why don't we do the WIC program? Why isn't it fully funded? In Minnesota, we have a state subsidy for it of several million dollars, very tiny state subsidy. It's more symbolic than anything else, but less than half the Minnesota children who are eligible for the program qualify. I'd argue that common sense, economics, as well as what's good for the child's well-being, which frankly I think should be our higher priority, in both of those areas, why don't we fully fund a program like that? If we were doing that 4 years ago, we'd be saving money by now several times over for every dollar we invested. And if we started now, we'd be saving it 4 years from now. Certainly along with that, the school breakfast and school lunch programs that many states have in conjunction with federal government, I think in addition to the nutritional benefits of it, teachers who have children who they know are coming to school hungry, it's hard to concentrate on your work when your stomach, if you didn't eat breakfast this morning, you're hungry now, you're going to have less attention paid to this and more attention paid to your stomach. Certainly among little kids, I think that's more true. Those are programs that I think for the good of the education system we ought to be doing. And I'll pick out another one before opening it up. Early childhood education is another big one. I think the most well-known of those programs is the federal Head Start program. I think it's gotten to the point where people of both parties recognize the benefit of it. Our governor this past year in his State of the State address made a great point about how he was going to work on prevention, and for every, it's far wiser to spend $2,600 a child on Head Start than to spend $30,000 a year later on to take care of prison costs. And there is an impact on prison population related to Head Start. Michigan, there's some 25-year studies of the Head Start program, and it does not only help the kids do better in school academically, makes them more likely to hold jobs, it does reduce crime, and they've got some control groups of similar situated kids over that 25-year period. It does reduce crime. For social purposes, why don't we fully fund the Head Start program? This governor and legislature, the opposite party, who also say good things about the same program, we fund less than half the need for the program. And there certainly are lots of other childhood family education types of programs that do much for crime prevention, they do much for reducing special education costs later on. The children who go to school knowing what a book is and being ready to learn how to read and learn, period, are at a lot better stage than those who aren't familiar with anything. They've never seen a book, never been read to in their life. They're at a big disadvantage, and the cost to the schools is much greater then. And along with this, family parenting education can do much to reduce child abuse. Minnesota has had a couple of highly publicized cases in our state, as I assume many states have had in recent years, about baby shaking cases, where a parent in a fit of anger shakes the baby violently enough, which apparently isn't that violently, in order to cause brain damage. In those cases, I mean, it's miserable to think of. The child, in several cases, has been killed or permanently brain damaged, a vegetable for the rest of their lives, at cost of literally millions of dollars to the society. And on top of that, the parents in Minnesota at least will end up in prison for doing so. And one of the prosecutors who prosecuted one of those cases said, boy, that's inappropriate. They basically destroy this whole child's life, this innocent child's life, and now we gotta crack down harder. A several-year sentence isn't enough. Well, that's at $30,000 a year to lock them up. Wouldn't it be far smarter to invest the money in a proposal there was this year for $8 million in child abuse prevention, because I guess I can see that is even not intentional child abuse. Is that in, it's not this building, or is it this building? Is it this building, or is it
building? Right.
If it is this building, then we're supposed to get out of here for a few minutes.
This building.
We'll come back and see what's going on. If the tape ministry is listening, they can restart the tape. If not, there may be about an 18-minute gap, as somebody suggested to me. Nothing happened during that 18.
Of course not.
Except we resolved all the controversy and we're done. Anyway, I've tried to throw out a number of types of things where I think government can either promote some better social good, environmental protection, or child abuse prevention, and often at the same time be saving money. And I guess one of the things I'd like to do is open it up for discussion, not just to throw out, you think you can save money in this area, but actually have a discussion over those areas. Yes?
For government to act, there needs to be some kind of a consensus on what approach to take. And doesn't that become one of the larger problems that you have, like in the two-party system? There, you may agree that this is a desirable objective, but the way of getting to the solution may be quite different. And isn't that one of the biggest problems that politicians have in taking action?
The issue of, is the problem that we can't get to these things because we can't agree on how to get there. There's certainly some of that in a whole lot of areas. I will make the argument that a lot of the areas where I'm trying to focus on the long-term objective rather than the short-term is not because of there's a disagreement on whether it's a desirable thing to do or not. It's either because nobody's taking a look at it, or the argument we can't afford it, or something else. But I don't think people are saying, well, what we got to do is we got to get that Head Start program better. They're saying, people of both parties say, it's a good program, yeah, we ought to do it, but, well, yeah, we got other priorities right now. And so the economics of these things are perhaps a big controversy. I mean, if these things were all 100% unanimous agreement on them, they'd happen. But two of the things I was suggesting earlier in the causes were, one, nobody's taking the time to look and find out where we might be able to, or at least not pushing hard enough to promote things that we can probably agree would save problems from getting worse or whatever. And certainly the economics and that are some of the reasons, but I'm trying to focus on ones not here. We could spend a lot of time discussing what, and I have a talk I think later this week on crime prevention issues. We could spend a lot of time arguing, is this going to prevent crime or not going to prevent crime? And I hope to get into some of those kind of things at that time. But there are clearly some things we know have a positive impact, or we can make a pretty solid guess are going to have a positive impact. And so what I'm trying to get is a list of ideas and discussion on those. Is there some consensus on some other types of areas where we can save money? And I'll suggest I think there is. And that's what I'd like to open up for.
That's maybe a kind of loaded question for you, John. But, you mentioned that one of the reasons that politicians don't plan ahead because they plan for the next election or something like that. There's a lot of talk in the country about limiting terms to maybe one or two terms. What do you think about that as a way of, the politician's only going to be in office for one term, maybe 4, 6, even 10 years, something like that. He can act without having to worry about re-election. I think that's a good idea, huh?
Can get into that at more length later. I, in general, have not supported that. And the biggest, a couple of reasons. One is, I think some of the best legislators are people who've been around for 15, 20 years for a couple of reasons. One, there are certain expertises that you develop in time. I don't think the experts in Minnesota tax policy or finance for various, like our higher education financing system. I think most of them have been around 8, 9, 10 years at a minimum before they truly have a good understanding of that.
But number, can't you hire that kind of expertise?
Of staff? Mm-hmm. I would argue if you are replacing the elected official with the staff and lobbyists, those two groups have, I'd say, undue power in the system. And I'd argue that what was a better approach, and let's take two leaders, I think. I'll take one of each party, one of each end of the spectrum. I'd suggest that from the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, Claude Pepper from Florida was a very valuable contributor to public policy, especially on aging issues, over 30, 40 years. I don't think the country would have been better off kicking him out of office. From the conservative point of view, I think Barry Goldwater, who was also around in politics for 30-some years, I think he was a much more eloquent, better educated spokesperson than a whole lot of first-term U.S. senators were. And I frankly would suggest that rather than getting people in for one or two terms, some of the worst legislators are brand new ones. Some of them are also the people who just hang around for 30 years and never do anything. I guess that's a whole other issue I don't want to get into anymore now because I want to keep focusing on the long-term thing. But if somebody doesn't have to worry at all about re-election, will they spend more time doing that? Well, perhaps, perhaps not. Do they have the time to think about it? Will people, before they ever decide they want to run for office, spend the time developing this creative agenda to address long-term concerns? And then the day they're elected, they're going to jump in there and start accomplishing it. I'm not sure that that would be a big contributor to doing that. I don't know that it would hurt it or help it. It probably have some positives and some negatives. In general, I've opposed that, not that I intend to be around 20 years in Minnesota legislature. I may feel differently 10 years from now. But at this point, I do think there's some bad reasons for doing that. I'd suggest the way to get more turnover is to have more fair election process, so there is more turnover. Minnesota Senate, about half of it is turned over since I was elected in 86. That's pretty heavy turnover. The U.S. Congress has greater problems with that, and I think we have to address that as a separate issue. But I don't see that as being the main hindrance. I mean, I think there are a whole lot of greater problems with getting the long-term approach rather than people who are just worried about their re-election. So as I mentioned, I think that's one cause of it.
I think at least right now there's a perception among a lot of people that government-operated programs almost per se are wasteful and just, you know, throwing money for mm-hmm. no results. And maybe one way to encourage long-term thinking is for more information to be disseminated about programs that do
that are successful.
Why, and why they're a good investment. Because I think an awful lot of people are just operating from ignorance and gut-level reactions and not on any kind of evidence.
On that issue, I think you're right. That's one of the causes, an appropriate one, on why public opinion is not behind there. Let's go ahead and do these things. I would argue the greatest single waste we have in government is this particular issue. If we know that the Women, Infant, Children Nutrition Program, we have pretty good evidence that it's saving more than $3 for every dollar we spend. It's a horrible waste not to do it fully. And I can point out lots of things that I think are wasteful in Minnesota state government. And there's always disagreement on what waste is, first of all. And there's waste in every business, every household budget, or at least I think most people would agree they don't spend every penny as wisely as they could. And I'll agree Minnesota state government doesn't either. But I think by and large, I'll say, I think I spend more time working on those little things, and I feel strongly about it for two reasons. One, because I think we need more money for the right things, and every dollar wasted on that takes away a dollar from that. And number two, it builds on this public distrust of government, which prevents government from getting involved in the things it should be doing. So I think we don't dare ignore the waste problem for either of those two reasons. And I think you're right that that is one of the reasons the public is critical of government, rightly so critical of government. But if I had to say what the one biggest thing we could do to save money, I mean, all my colleagues talk all the time, oh, we're going to stamp out this waste, and their campaign literature talks about how they've done this or that to stamp out waste in government, and every candidate does it, and I think every candidate believes in doing it. If it was so easy to do, it would have been done long ago. Newsweek wrote an article, somebody told me, I haven't seen it yet, after a garbage forum the other night, somebody showed me a copy of a Newsweek article, talked about four states and how they dealt with the recent budget crises. And Minnesota was one of the four states, and it was several paragraphs, it wasn't a long thing. And it mentioned that the state spent $50,000 on some marble trash receptacles and ashtrays for the state capitol building. And they're hideous things. I mean, they really are hideous. And about 5 years ago, it did happen. And I don't know who approved it. The Historical Society, I believe, is in charge of the capitol complex itself. They're hideous. I don't think they fit in with the capitol at all. They're impractical, and it's a terrible waste of money. But $50,000 in the $15 billion biennial budget once 4 years ago, I don't think I'd bring that up in discussing how the state dealt with the crisis now. And I can point that out as a terrible waste of money. So those things are out there, but in 1 year, if we spent another $15 billion on the WIC program, and by 3 years from now we're saving $45 million, that's $1 million, not $50,000. I'd say that's where the real waste occurs. But you're right, that's one of the hindrances to getting the public support for government to do some appropriate things, and how to get the word out about good things government does. It's a tough one. And I think a legitimate question to ask.
Part of the tension seems to me is that you have X number of dollars to work with. And to take an example, I have a step that causes everyone to fall on and trip and skin their knees. So therefore I have to go out and buy Band-Aids to put a Band-Aid on and stop the bleeding. Now, the tension we get caught in is we will no longer buy Band-Aids because we can only, that's the only way we can afford to fix the step. But if we do that before we get it fixed, there's still people scraping their knees and we still need Band-Aids. So we get caught in the tension in the process of waiting for the WIC program to take effect and really work so we can eliminate some of the money. We still have to have that money there, but we're caught with only X number of dollars. Mm-hmm. And there's a tension there that creatively the politicians hopefully can do both for a while until one can be eliminated. But you're caught.
That's exactly what I was going to get at the end after some of this discussion of specific items to some of the, what are the obstacles? How can we accomplish this? And one of, perhaps the biggest single obstacle is the financial one. How do you deal with it? And my argument would be simply, and it's a bad news one, and you hate to tell this to constituents, and I doubt there are any constituents in here, though I've said the same thing to constituents because I think it's something the public has to hear. And that is, whenever somebody criticizes, I'll get to your, I'm sorry, I missed your hand earlier, I'll get it in just a second. Whenever somebody criticizes state government or something for having this year our human service budget went up by 23% over the past 2 year period, and every other finance committee chair who is in charge of the higher education finance saying, look, they're cutting our budget, look, they're doing this, and transportation people, we're cutting our budget and we're dumping all this money into human services. We can't afford these 23% increases, and I agree, but the point is, the way we're doing it, at 23%, we're going to have 23% increases 4 years from now, too. We're going to have it 8 years from now, too, unless we begin to get in front of some of those problems. What are those problems? Some of it's prisons, that's our human service budget. Some of it's special education costs. Some of it's nursing home, the largest part of it's nursing home costs. And with an aging population, we can see the writing on the wall. That's going to continue to grow unless we find creative ways to keep people out of nursing homes. So you're right, that is the tension, but it's that you're going to pay me now or you're going to pay me later. It's your choice, and unfortunately, because we don't have the guts to tell people, we kind of don't believe people can understand that. I think people can, but because politicians are unwilling to talk about taxes in a fair way, and that means fairly raising and fairly wisely spending them. They duck the issue and we put off the problem, and then we moan and groan about how the human service budget grows. You've been waiting a long time. Sorry about that.
You mentioned that you felt the WIC program was underfunded by the state of Minnesota. I wonder to what extent could it be said that one of the reasons for underfunding it is that maybe some legislatures simply don't believe that's an appropriate use of governmental monies. That is, taking care of women, infant, and children is a family responsibility, and the government simply ought not be involved in those kinds of things. The American way is for individuals and families to take care of that.
Okay. Did everybody hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My simple response is, first of all, I don't think in the legislature, not the Minnesota legislature, I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's the case in the U.S. Congress. There may be in a few state legislatures and a few individual legislators, both at the federal and the state levels, who feel that way. I think our country, about 30 or 40 years ago, made a lot of decisions about getting involved in human services. We don't want to have people starve in our country anymore. And I think, by and large, public opinion and political office holder opinion is such that bipartisan, that we're not going to let people starve. Unfortunately, because of that kind of attitude, we come to 10 years ago, we had a president talking about, we're going to have a safety net for the truly needy. We don't want anybody to starve. Nobody from the far right to the far left in our country wants anybody to go hungry in the United States. And so we're going to take care of people who, if they're going to starve, we'll give them enough food to take them care of them today until tomorrow. I'd argue it's a very short-sighted approach, and something like WIC may be a much smarter way of doing it than that, because if you're taking care of the truly needy, then as soon as they earn $1 in a job, well, they need one less dollar to make them survive. And by doing that, you constantly pull the rungs off the economic ladder where they can bring themselves to self-sufficiency. And I'd argue welfare reform is needed so that we can get people out of poverty. In terms of the WIC program, the reason it's needed is because often single parents with their kids, can criticize them for being single parents if you want, you can criticize them for not having decent jobs, whatever. I think most people in this country, and I'd say 90-some percent, I'd say it's as close to consensus as you can get, don't think we should let kids go hungry in this country because their parents don't have a job, or they're too lazy to work, or they can't find a job, or they're whatever. Whatever the reason, I think there's a pretty good consensus that at least the basic level of keeping people out of starvation, keeping people from freezing to death, should do it. Well, what about the church's role? Why not soup kitchens, food shelves? Churches in Minnesota have been funding more and more and more of that. And church people I talk to about it are saying, look, we've got to do other things. We're a church, and that's not our main function, perhaps. And they're all saying what a stupid way it is to do it. And they're not meeting the need. And it keeps getting worse every year. The food shelves, and everybody behind them was begging for some state dollars to go to food shelves now. Food shelves were supposed to be emergencies for people who fall in the cracks. I would argue that is not, people may believe that. There may be a few legislators who believe it's not the role of government to take care of some basic human needs. But I don't think that's the stumbling block to looking at long-term approach, because it's such a small minority in either party and any state or federal government that I'd argue that's not the reason it is. There are certainly some things that people question, should government be involved in this or that area? But I would argue that with most of these kind of things, it's not because of disagreement on whether government should do that or not. Anyway, I wanted to sum up a few things, but I wanted to find out if people have other kinds of things they'd like to discuss in terms of other areas, like the ones I gave of energy conservation or child nutrition.
I'd like to just barely raise the question of education, and mm-hmm. This isn't my expertise, but it's an observation that those children that come away the best educated in a school system are those where the parents are actively concerned and involved. And it is not a function of how much money the school system has to spend per child, but on how much parental involvement is there to support the system. And so it appears that throwing more money into the school system doesn't necessarily improve the quality of education, as you would like, or many would like you to hear. And more government participation, but maybe a government program to try to get parents more involved or something like that is a better way to go. This may be one of these different approaches type of thing. But I
don't know if there's strong disagreement with that either. Well, the part about getting more parental involvement.
How you do it is a real
how problem. You do it is where you get to controversy perhaps and other things. I would suggest that you need both the government involvement in adequate funding as well as the parental involvement. I'm hearing from constituents who, hearing from some of my colleagues who say the teachers' unions have too much clout and teachers are overpaid, and I'm hearing a significant amount of people saying that among colleagues and so on in the last year or so, who are very upset about that, and they say, therefore we cut money. So what happens, rightly or wrongly, you get larger class sizes, you cut back on this, you cut back on that. And I think we can say, I don't think there's big disagreement with among partisan basis or other basis, that taking away dollars from the schools tends to make the schools worse. Having said that, have we done enough to get parents involved? Not by a long shot. Our daughter started kindergarten last year, and we read to her every night of her life. And she was recognizing words before she started kindergarten, and I know certain other households in certain neighborhoods in Minneapolis where the kids haven't even seen a book. Are they ready to read? Went to a kindergarten teacher in St. Paul last year, and she was talking about, it was not a lowest income neighborhood, but pretty close to that in St. Paul, and 900 kids in this elementary school. How many parents involved in the PTA? Two. You're right. The parents have to be involved, and sometimes Minnesota this year actually did try a couple creative government things to encourage parental involvement, to give the school districts a little bit of extra money, money again, but money designed to get parents involved. There are all kinds of proposals to require employers to allow parents at least a day off during the school year if they would go spend the time in the child's school visiting teachers or whatever, so they'd feel more attachment to it. I think you're clearly right, that has to happen as well. I would argue that education is one of these areas that is a good payback in the long run, and simply with most of these things, more government dollars may be an answer or part of an answer, but it's probably almost never or never the whole answer. And sometimes you may need more dollars to make up for the fact that parents either don't care or don't have time. Single parents struggling to survive may not be able to spend a lot of time teaching their kids when they work two jobs.
Yeah, I think that one of the things we need is we need more equality in our taxation. The kid in inner city, and I'm very active volunteer in inner city, and I was a social worker for years in Detroit. And it's not fair, the conditions that they have to go to school. And now I'm doing a lot of tutoring. And those parents, they have reasons why they oftentimes can't be active. Sure, there are some. You know, we have that out in the suburbs that don't come to PTA.
Yeah.
But I think the basic is that there's got to be a change in the tax structure
In Minnesota, we have a lawsuit going on whether we equitably fund education. And because it's largely state dollars to local school districts, it's pretty even. I mean, the difference may be between $2,700 and $3,600 per pupil, as opposed to Texas, where I think the richest school district, they've been federal courts have forced them to make some changes. I recall hearing the richest school district was spending, I don't know, 8 or 10 times what the poorest districts were. Those equity issues are very important ones too, but and I think they all relates to, if we believe a good education is a good investment in the future, which I would argue it is, and again, that's controversial too, one of those controversies you were talking about, because all of these, every political issue, or many of these political issues do involve issues of dollars. And fiscal responsibility in the last, maybe forever, in politics has meant spending less. I would argue in many times, fiscal responsibility means spending less in the long term, not looking at the 2 year. What's it gonna do? If I vote to spend an extra $5 million on the WIC program in Minnesota this year, I'm gonna be, quote, a big spender and wasteful of tax dollars, whereas my opponent can say, ah, he's more fiscally responsible, he'd cut the state budget by $5. I would make the argument that if we're gonna come to 5 years from now at some point, and we're gonna be spending that money in the long run anyhow, and if we could save three times that amount of money by spending it now, I'd argue I'm being more fiscally responsible for doing that. And certainly among priorities of programs, the first ones cut tend to be the ones that have the best payback because they're not the crisis ones. It's the crisis approach that Doug mentioned that we have to fund first. We can't let people out of prison, dangerous criminals out of prison, to victimize again, despite the high cost of it. That's kind of a necessity, a crisis we have to deal with because of it. And we're never going to eliminate crime, so even if you did all the crime prevention things I'd propose, you're not going to eliminate crime. But if you cut our prison population by a third in doing it, you could pay for three times that many crime prevention programs.
To raise another issue, because you kind of alluded to that, what about the medical subsidies? For example, Wilmer happens to be kind of a regional center for medicine right now, and I'm very good friends with the administrator, and he said we're caught right now because all the clinics around us are turning people away because they're getting about a 50-cent return on the dollar spent, and we can't keep doctors here for that. So they're coming to Wilmer, and now they've just opened up the ethical issue among the doctors and the staff there. What are we going to do?
Are we going to turn them away, too?
Are we going to turn them away, too? And he's been told, as he's gone to his lobbyists as well as legislators to discuss this issue, that who he's talked to has said, turn them away, because as long as you continue to meet their needs for 50 cents on the dollar, there's no need for us to supply you with more. The response?
That's exactly what's happening. As long as the hospital's dental, we increased reimbursement for dentists this year. And I don't really feel great sorrow for dentists struggling to survive. But having said that, the ones who are taking medical assistance recipients, whether they're because of elderly poor or non-elderly poor, they're losing money on it when they pay their dental hygienists and office costs and so on. They lose money on every person they take. How many of them would you take if you were a dentist? I mean, you do it because you care about people and about their teeth. We have more and more dentists saying, forget it, I'm gonna just drop out of the program altogether. I'm losing too much money on it. We get to the issue of, well, we're gonna re-increase the reimbursement rate for dentists, and oh, those rich dentists, why should we care about them? Well, it becomes a real issue, and shortage of healthcare is one of the most critical issues facing us. I think the health care access plan in Minnesota this past year that I thought was a good start in making health care affordable to people. I think we have to be addressing that issue. The whole health care issue, when you look at the parent who does not take their kid to the doctor when they've got a fever that might be an ear infection and they can't tell, and well, we'll wait a day or two and see if